Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, in for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Republican Congressman Steve Scalise is still in critical condition after being shot during that GOP baseball practice yesterday. He was hit in the hip but suffered organ damage. President Trump visited him last night and spoke this morning.
It's been much more difficult than people even thought at the time. It's been he's in some trouble, but he's a great fighter and he's going to be okay, we hope.
A lobbyist who was shot is also still in the hospital. The shooter, James Hodgkinson, was shot by police, later died. NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie has been following all of this. And Greg, he's in some trouble. What more do we know about Representative Scalise?
Well, we know, as you mentioned, that the bullet went through his hip, fractured some bones, damaged internal organs, caused a lot of severe bleeding. So that seems to be the main source of the problem. He had two surgeries yesterday. He's had or is having or has had now a third surgery today. And he's still in critical condition. So this is quite serious.
We hear, though, that the other victims seem to be doing well.
Generally, yes. Two of the other shooting victims seem to be recovering very nicely. Matt Mika, this is the lobbyist for Tyson Foods. He's still in intensive care, as far as we know. So we have three other shooting victims in various states of recovery.
Yeah. So what more are we learning about the alleged shooter, James Hodgkinson, from Belleville, Illinois, a Bernie Sanders volunteer, had been living in Virginia since I think it was March in a white van. Many people came into contact with him at the Y.
Oh, absolutely. He was not trying to hide in any sense. Seemingly, since about the end of March, he was living out of this white cargo van, basically in the parking lot of the YMCA, and people saw him every morning there in the Y. He wasn't working out. He seemed to be sort of living out of his gym bag. He'd take a shower there, stare out the or look at his laptop in front of a window. The window faced the ball fields where the shootings took place, about 50 yards away. So it was right there. In that spot. The former mayor of Alexandria, Bill Ewell, said he met with him 20 times. He's a chatty guy. He sat down and had coffee with him. Didn't really think the guy was that strange or nothing that set off alarm bells. He was seen at local restaurants. So he left a very clear trail, wasn't trying to hide.
Well, so interesting because he was right there by the park. And so there are people concluding that he was waiting and looking for Congressman Scalise because he'd once, you know, mentioned him negatively, so he must have been targeting him. But then we also hear from the other Republicans who were there that this man, who they did not know was going to be a shooter, asked if the players were Republican or Democrat, so he didn't even seem to know what he had in front of him.
Right. And that's really one of the mysteries. If he came to Washington intending to carry out an attack, he was sitting in this sort of suburban area. It was not the center of political activity. So it's sort of a strange place to put yourself if you're looking to go after people who were on Capitol Hill. These guys had been practicing 3 days a week for several weeks. So it's possible he did have some inkling of what was going on. But yesterday was, in fact, the last practice of probably, more than a dozen or more practices they'd had there, because tonight the actual game will be played.
Yeah. Well, he had run-ins with the law, reportedly punched his daughter's boyfriend, punched through a door to pull his daughter out of a house, been arrested for battery, among other things. You report on his shooting off a gun and police having to come and asking him to stop. And yet we're also hearing from people who knew him that they can't believe that this is the guy who did this. He showed no signs. And he had guns. Obviously, he'd been able to get them.
Right. He's from southern southwest Illinois. He, by all media accounts that we're seeing, had those guns legally. And there were a couple episodes where law enforcement got called in. The most recent was on March 24th. He was sort of shooting into some trees outside his house, which is a fairly rural area. So some neighbors called police. Police came, told him to stop it, but didn't arrest him or charge him with anything. And it seems right after that episode, or within a couple days of that episode, is when he came to Washington.
Well, what might happen now? This morning, President Trump spoke more about Congressman Steve Scalise. Let's listen.
And Steve, in his own way, may have brought some unity to our long divided country. We've had a very, very divided country for many years. And I have a feeling that Steve has made a great sacrifice, but there could be some unity being brought to our country.
Do you think that's going to happen? We already have Representative Steve King say he blames Barack Obama for what happened. He told WHO Iowa Radio that it was Barack Obama who divided us. Others are pointing out it was Donald Trump who told his supporters at campaign rallies to go after people, protesters. He'd you know, back them up. That's happening. You know, so do you think there's going to be unity?
We see this very clear trend, Robin. You get a temporary unity after these sort of shooting events. You may just recall a few months back, a gunman came into a pizza parlor in Northwest Washington based on a fake news report about Hillary Clinton and fired some shots. So there is this temporary unity saying tone down the rhetoric, but then it eventually dissolves and goes away, yeah. And we get back to the vitriol.
Well, let's see. NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
The first pitch of the 2017 College World Series is this Saturday in Omaha, Nebraska. And like other major sporting events, the NCAA Baseball Championship brings a lot of fans in and sadly also people being sold for sex. But sex trafficking is also a problem outside Nebraska's largest city in rural small towns. Mike Tobias from NET News reports, and a warning, this story deals with the subject matter of an adult nature.
Most of our trafficking victims, this is kind of where we're going to start as far as once we...
Jamie Manzer gives me a tour of the SASA Crisis Center. It helps domestic and sexual violence victims. That includes women sold against their will for sex. We're in SASA's gifts room, stocked with basics like soap, toothpaste, and T-shirts.
Most of our trafficking victims feel dirty, and that's more symbolic than realistic.
SASA is a first point of contact for people escaping trafficking. Manzer led the organization for several years. During one, they saw 14 sex trafficking victims. SASA isn't located in a big city. It's in Hastings, in central Nebraska, population 25,000. The agency serves mostly rural counties.
What we're typically seeing are acquaintances, partners, prostituting out their intimate partner, most typically a male pimping out a female, though that's not always the case. And what we're seeing is it's for drugs, it's for alcohol, it's for access to shelter.
Manzer says they once helped women being trafficked in a town of just 500 people. They've seen women being trafficked at a county fair, even the state fair nearby Grand Island, a city of 50,000.
For the state fair, we did have three ladies brought on motorcycle from Daytona Beach, Florida, into the community, locked in hotels for multiple days. And then the gentleman who'd brought them there, who they thought they knew and thought were acquaintances of theirs, brought multiple men in, blindfolded them, forced them to have sex. So they couldn't even tell me who they'd had sex with, how many times.
It happens virtually anywhere.
Stephen O'Mara was the Nebraska Attorney General's first human trafficking coordinator.
Even if you just followed the major interstate system that all the way from Omaha out through Scotts Bluff, there is measurable sex trafficking that occurs virtually all the time, particularly during major events, but all the time across all of Nebraska.
Although it's faced legal challenges, the Classified Ads website Backpage is still one of the places buyers are looking and traffickers are selling. Backpage's dating area includes listings that leave little to the imagination. One typical ad offers a, quote, classy and erotic woman available in a rural city.
The commercial sex market is strong across the state.
Krista Price is co-director of Creighton University's Human Trafficking Initiative, which researches the area's commercial sex industry. They did a deep dive analysis of thousands of Backpage posts and found 900 people are sold for sex each month in Nebraska. Almost all are female. Some are likely involved in voluntary prostitution, but three-fourths have some signs of being trafficked. A map shows where sex is for sale in Nebraska. There's lots of activity in the state's larger cities, but also indications of activity in towns of 2,000. Terry Clark co-directs the initiative. He says there's a reason commercial sex posts include references to these small towns.
There's got to be a clientele there, and it wouldn't be one or two people.
Again, Stephen O'Mara.
If there's any kind of a viable prostitution market, there is almost certainly sex trafficking in that location. And the reality is there is a viable prostitution market adjusted for population virtually everywhere.
The Creighton University research shows levels of per capita commercial sex activity similar to Nebraska in states like Minnesota, Kansas, and Iowa. Fighting sex trafficking is difficult anywhere, but there are special challenges in rural areas, including frontline agencies with limited resources and training. Jamie Manzer of SASA says it's hard for trafficking victims to privately get help in everyone-knows-everyone small towns, and isolation of victims in rural areas is a common tool used by traffickers. Her message? Sex is for sale everywhere, and those being sold don't want to be.
And I think that once we can understand that piece of it, that every time you're looking at a prostitute, you're probably looking at a victim of human trafficking. My hope is that that subtle demand will be affected, and that by consequence, supply will dwindle.
Dwindling from rural areas where people are surprised to learn that sex trafficking happens. For Here and Now, I'm Mike Tobias.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has said that one of his driving principles is, quote, move fast and break things, that unless you're breaking things, you aren't moving fast enough. Zuckerberg explained more at a TechCrunch event in 2013.
You know, sometimes we go too fast and we mess up a bunch of stuff and then we have to fix it. And that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, that's cool if you're talking about an algorithm. But what if you are breaking democracy? Well, Jonathan Taplin says tech giants like Facebook, Google, and Amazon are in fact doing just that. He says they're modern-day monopolies that threaten the foundation of our country. Taplin is the director emeritus of the Annenberg Innovation Lab at the University of Southern California, and his new book is Move Fast and Break Things, How Facebook, Google, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. Jonathan Taplin, welcome.
Thank you, Meghna. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. So make the case for us. How is it that Facebook, Google, and Amazon are undermining democracy?
Well, you know, I have to get a little bit of historical perspective. When the internet was first conceived by Tim Berners-Lee and Vint Cerf and other people, the whole idea was to decentralize network control. We were living in a world where there were three TV networks and maybe one newspaper in any city, and so that was a good idea. But 10 years later, in the 80s, Peter Thiel came out of Stanford, Larry Page came out of Stanford, Jeff Bezos was beginning Amazon, and they realized that the internet was really a winner-takes-all business, that there would be one great search giant, there would be one great social network, there would be one great e-commerce giant. Mm. What's known as the network effect means the more people you have on your network, the more people want to be on your network. So, you know, Facebook can take on, say, Snapchat and basically undermine them deeply by taking all their great ideas and just putting it on Facebook. And who needs Snapchat?
Right.
So these elements began to create these platforms in which supposedly nobody had any control. So both Google and Facebook act as if they have no control of what goes on Facebook or what goes on YouTube. And that, of course, leads to this fake news epidemic that we're going through right now. Because a kid in Macedonia can create a fake news account, create the ability using robots to bomb the Facebook algorithm, move his post up to the top of the trending topics, and get more attention, as the charts have shown in my book, than the real news.
And this matters primarily because Facebook has such giant reach, basically. I mean, if Facebook only had a couple of thousand users, it wouldn't matter at all. And to that point, I mean, you write about, really, I don't think people fully understand or can fathom the size of these companies in their respective spaces, if I can use business speak here a little bit. I mean, Google has, what, 88% of market share in search advertising? And you've written that Facebook with Instagram, WhatsApp, and Messenger has 77% of mobile social traffic, and Amazon has almost 75% share in e-books, for example. So they really are enormous companies.
They're not just enormous in terms of their own business sectors. They're the largest companies in the world. And so they totally not only dominate the tech world, they dominate politics, and they were able to kind of create a way to get things done that not only is, to my sense, destructive to the news business, because think about what's happened in the news business. You know, revenues in newspapers since Google arrived have dropped by 75%. There are 50% fewer people working in journalism today than there were 10 years ago. In the music business, the revenues have fallen by 75% as well. And if you, for instance, have a popular tune and you could get it 1 million downloads on iTunes, you could make $900,000. If you got 1 million streams on YouTube, you'd make $900.
Yeah.
And so this is really destructive for the creative classes of America. And these people really don't seem to care much how they're destroying these things.
Jonathan Tamblyn, just let me jump in here because, I mean, as you well know, the classic sort of business response to that is what you're describing is Clay Christian-esque disruption. That's just what happens when industries become static, when they lack innovative muscle. They are going to get disrupted by companies that start out small, try new things, and turn out to do those things better.
Yeah, but are they doing things better? Is the news ecology that we live in today, with 50% of the people who think that Facebook is their primary source of their news, are we really making this better? Is the music business better today than it was 10 years ago? I would argue no. 80% of the revenue in the music business last year went to 1% of the content.
You know, in the past, whenever the United States has encountered industries or companies that become too big, too powerful, too monopolistic, and therefore perhaps a threat to democracy, there have been solutions, right? We break them up or we regulate them heavily. Is that what you're advocating here for Facebook, Google, and Amazon?
I mean, the only question that I'm asking, is there a market solution to this problem? So ask yourselves, if someone came to you and said, look, I have this great idea, I'm going to start a new search engine to compete against Google, would you give that person a large amount of money? I doubt it.
Let me just jump in here. I'm going to push back a little because I think that's exactly where the tech sector would say, no, we would give them a lot of money. We would try it out. And if it fails, it fails. But eventually, because once you get funding, the actual barriers to entry for a lot of these businesses are so low that they'll find the next great idea.
That's a total myth. There has not been a new search engine started in 10 years. And look at, as I used the example of Snapchat before. So Snapchat came up with some really innovative ideas, and Facebook offered to buy them. The people at Snapchat turned them down, and then Facebook just basically turned around and said, okay, your fault. We're going to kill you. So, I mean, this is the way that monopolists act. So my theory is it may be that the only solution is some kind of regulation. Now, from the point of view of musicians, a simple thing would be to say to YouTube, if I tell you to take something down from YouTube, I want it to stay down. Mm-hmm. I don't want to play this game of whack-a-mole. Every time I file a takedown notice, it goes down, and 2 days later, it goes up from another user. So that's one thing you could do. The second thing we really ought to think about is privacy. I mean, if you think about these three businesses that I'm writing about, their business is surveillance capitalism. They're in only one business, which is renting their databases to advertisers or using their databases to sell you stuff.
I mean, but users are doing so. I hate to say this because I'm a privacy freak myself, but I've got to say, like, users are doing this willingly.
It's true. But think about this. A neurobiologist came up to me 2 weeks ago and said, I'm going to send you a research paper we did that shows that you can use a smartphone, the same thing that tells you how many steps you walked up on your way to the office, to record the tremors of Parkinson's disease. Okay. Now, are they going to sell that to your health insurance company? Are they going to sell that to your employer? The people from Consumer Reports came to me and said, you may think that your driving auto insurance rates are set by how well you drive. It has nothing to do with that. It's where you drive. Mm-hmm. Well, where do they get that data? Right. We all know where they get it, yeah, from the smartphone.
I mean, you do think that there are particular forms of regulation that could be, I mean, political feasibility aside, that could be enacted to curb the monopolistic threat that you see with Facebook, Google, and Amazon, right? Is that right?
So one of the possibilities was the way we handled the AT&T monopoly in the 50s. So AT&T was the monopoly phone company in 1950, and we went to them and said, you have to allow your research and development group, which is called Bell Labs, they have to license every patent they own to any other American firm for free in return for you staying a monopoly. Those free patents created Texas Instruments, Motorola, Intel, Fairchild Semiconductor, Comsat, and hundreds of other companies that grew out of these free patents. But, you know, Google doesn't license its search algorithms or its autonomous car patents. In fact, it sues people to keep them from using. So maybe that's one possible solution. I mean, ultimately, it may be that we have to break them up, that maybe Facebook has to sell Instagram. Maybe Facebook has to sell, WhatsApp. Maybe Google has to sell YouTube. That is the kind of remedies that have been implied in the past. But, you know, the antitrust divisions have been asleep since Reagan. Mm. And I'm not sure under Trump they're going to wake up.
Right. Well, Jonathan Taplin is Director Emeritus of the Annenberg Innovation Lab at the University of Southern California. His new book is Move Fast and Break Things, How Facebook, Google, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. Jonathan Taplin, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes it easy to cook nutritionist-approved meals in your own kitchen with organic, non-GMO ingredients from farms and fishermen sent directly to your door. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and family options. You'll get pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow directions and get dinner on the table in 30 minutes. It's healthy cooking designed to fit your busy lifestyle, and it's delicious. Here and Now listeners get their first three meals free at sunbasket.com/now.
Verizon completed its $4.5 billion takeover of Yahoo earlier this week. And while Yahoo CEO Marissa Mayer is stepping down with a hefty $23 million payout, others are not so lucky. Verizon announced more than 2,000 layoffs this week. Lynette Lopez is senior finance correspondent for Business Insider, and she joins us from New York. Hi there.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So first of all, let's talk about those layoffs. Who are the more than 2,000 folks who are losing their jobs?
Well, we're not completely sure yet. We know that 39 people at HuffPo have been laid off. And this is 2,100 layoffs across AOL and across Yahoo. So that's about 14,000 people. The layoffs will not be uniform. Some departments will see 30% of their, you know, staff cut. Others will see 5%. But what we do know is that Yahoo is going to stick to its original, what some people think of its original business, which is search, email, and content.
Got it. So, Lynette, remind us, first of all, I mean, how did we get here? I mean, why did Yahoo Star fall as much as it did? And then why did Verizon want to buy it?
So I think that, you know, you've got to take this back 5 years before Marissa Mayer was even on the scene. Yahoo had six CEOs, the sixth being Mayer, in 5 years during that pre-period. That's really when Yahoo kind of lost its way and had its lunch eaten by Google and Facebook for search and advertising. And in that, during that time, it went through a very tumultuous period. People were constantly trying to come up with new ideas for the company, and Marissa Mayer was absolutely no slouch in that department. She made $3 billion worth of acquisitions. She poured $1.1 billion into buying Tumblr to see if that would work. And people were constantly calling Yahoo different things. Was it a media company? Was it a search company? No one really knew. Nobody could really put their finger on what Yahoo was. But there was one group of people that knew exactly what they wanted to do with the company. And that's the hedge fund managers and activist investors that were involved in Yahoo. They knew that they wanted to get the stock price to pop.
Right.
And in that way they succeeded over the last 5 years, the stock has gone up measurably. But we still don't know what Yahoo is. We still don't know what company it is. We don't know what it does. And we're literally back to square one, where we were even before Mayer got to the company.
Well, that's really interesting because, I mean, was it just this week at a conference in London that Marissa Mayer said she's, quote, looking forward to going back to Gmail? So,
yeah, yikes.
I mean,
wow.
Letting loose that she didn't even like Yahoo Mail. And yet she's walking away with this $23 million payout.
Oh, no. That's just the headline. She's walking away with $180 million some in restricted stocks, different kinds of stock. And she's made over $200 million at the company over the last 5 years. So she's walking away with way more than $23 million.
You can't see me right now, but I am shaking my head.
Yeah. I mean, and she performed for shareholders. If you don't care what the company actually makes and you don't care how many employees you're firing, they fought. Yahoo fired 15% of its workforce in 2016, which was an idea from activist investors who, again, wanted to see the stock pop. If you only care about Yahoo as a stock, then yeah, the last 5 years were definitely a success. But if you care about the company in terms of its product and also its employees, then this has been a massive, catastrophic failure.
Lynette Lopez is senior finance correspondent for Business Insider, speaking to us from New York. Thank you so much, Lynette.
There's news in the world of Muslim superheroes. Yes, there is such a world. And Variety's reporting that the female Muslim American superhero ISIS, named long before the terror group, will debut in a live-action TV show this fall, joining the CW show Legends of Tomorrow, which appears to be a first. There's also talk about a TV show for Ms. Marvel, another female Muslim superhero. This we learn from our friend A. David Lewis, a comic book expert who's also studied religious studies and now has co-edited the new book, Muslim Superheroes, Comics, Islam, and Representation. He's also a recent convert to Islam. A. Dave, as he's known in comic circles, joins us now. And Dave, we've talked before about Muslim superheroes, but people may be surprised to hear there have been so many in comic books.
There have been many, going as far back as our research finds to 1944, a character who's dear to me, Kismet, Man of Fate.
Kismet, Man of Fate.
Kismet, Man of Fate, first appeared in Bomber Comics, number one, in 1944. He has slight, small premonitions of the future, and he uses that to fight Nazis in wartime France.
So this is a good Muslim.
This is your good Muslim, exactly. And you get the sense that absolutely no Muslims were involved in the writing or illustrating of this character. Not surprising. This was 1940s New York. One of the things that comes out in the Muslim superheroes book is how often Muslim characters reflect either anxieties or viewpoints held by the U.S. population at large. Many times it's written by non-Muslims, sometimes not. We have notable exceptions that are worth examining. But when we use this genre, the superhero genre, to reflect and amplify and sometimes simplify what the national thinking is, what our engagement with other peoples are, it's a useful lens. And the point of this book was to sort of bring together with a scholarly eye, but a easy-to-read scholarly eye, what's been done thus far.
Well, I just want to hold you up on Kismet because it's, I'm thinking that, and after reading how many other characters there have been, mm-hmm. it could turn out that Arabs, Muslims, maybe had a better chance at good role models and good characterizations in comic books than they did in anything else. They've traditionally been the bad guys in movies and TV shows.
One thing that I've always loved about the superhero genre in comics is that it really has been an immigrant's genre. We have Superman from another planet. We have Wonder Woman from her Paradise Island. We have aliens. We have sorcerers. And they all seem to come together in a sense of unity, in a sense of shared space. Yes, this is a great space and a great place for Muslims and for Arabs, particularly if they're seen as other, to display non otherness, to display a sense of shared humanity.
Yeah.
And that comes across, I think, in a number of the essays in the collection.
We'll talk about some of the characters. Kamala Khan,
mm-hmm.
a New Jersey Muslim of Pakistani origin. She's often called Ms. Marvel.
That's right.
Tell us about her.
She's a terrific character, created in the past several years by G. Willow Wilson and Sama Amanat, Marvel Comics character who is herself a fangirl. She herself writes fan fiction and is excited about superheroes. So she's already at this great place of hybridity, at this intersectional mm-hmm. divide between what her many identities are. And she adds this identity of being costumed adventurer to many other identities, daughter, Muslima, friend, student. It's a wonderful blend that we may not have seen since Peter Parker, who was nerd, science geek, nephew. It's when we have this blend of identities that we find in Ms. Marvel that we have the most relatable characters.
Well, except you also have the best opportunity for criticism from all sides. So,
yes.
Yeah, for instance, you have Debbie Schlussel. She's a conservative commentator. When she heard about Ms. Marvel, she said, oh, no word on how many IEDs she'll be carrying, how many Jews she'll kill, of course, implying that she wouldn't do that, and so that wouldn't be a real depiction of a Muslim. Others say that the use of these Muslim characters is kind of creeping Shariaism, that it's like this sort of a Trojan horse way of getting people to accept them. And then you have Muslims saying, wait a second, that's not a true depiction of a chaste Muslim woman who would be in a
hijab. Oh, she's
hijab.
Too secular.
Yeah.
She's too assimilated. Yeah, she is not. Characters like Ms. Marvel, like Kismet, like Simon Baz, Muslim Green Lantern, they're not going to appeal to anyone who already have opinions at the fringes, opinions to the extremes. They're either fearing of Islam or, conversely, so fiercely protective of it that variations cannot be tolerated. I think this lends power to the characters. I think this makes them even more essential. Even if they draw critics, they're drawing the right critics, if that makes any sense.
Do you think Ms. Marvel will be in a movie? Well, I mean, and what do you, you know, how do you see what's the trajectory here?
She has already appeared. She's made her debut in Marvel Comics cartoons, in animation online. But there has been some rumors and talk of there being a television series in the works for her, not unlike Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Luke Cage, Daredevil. So we could see her in other media very soon.
And by the way, for people asking, you take this on too. It is not necessarily true you are Muslim convert, your wife is Muslim.
Yep.
It's not necessarily true that all Muslims are against exactly what we're talking about, which is depictions of Muslims, illustrations.
No. Yeah. It's been really wonderful to see young girls, or rather women of all ages, getting to dress up as Ms. Marvel proudly at comic book conventions, being able to identify. Comic books and Islam actually go pretty well together. They aren't antithetical.
Okay. In other comic news, just briefly, what do you make of the cancellation of author Ta-Nehisi Coates' comic Black Panther and the Crew? Just two episodes. It told the story of crime in Harlem, a mysterious death in police custody. You know, it was so anticipated. It sounds relevant. What do you make of that?
As much as I've been talking about Marvel, they have been in a little bit of a precarious situation. Their rival, DC Comics, has really taken the market share, so Marvel has had to reevaluate and cut back. Fortunately, Ta-Nehisi Coates still has the main Black Panther title running, so this cancellation of Black Panther and the Crew, while I agree is unfortunate, more of a pruning and less of a cutting off the entire root system. Mm. I think we need more representation of minorities in comics. I think it's been a white male-dominated genre for too long. But so long as his voice is still coming through in some title on some series, I remain optimistic.
Yeah. Quick note, too. You run a nonprofit. You're teaming up to give comics to Syrian refugee children.
Mm-hmm.
We've got pictures of them, reading them at herenow.org. Just very briefly, why?
Because it's what I can do. We're creating comics for them, and we're creating it from Syrian folklore, Syrian folk tales. Wow. So this is not us trying to impose stories or views on them, but rather give them the opportunity to reconnect with what they may have lost.
Wow. And very briefly, we asked you, what's the best comic out there? And I'm now holding it. I'm so lucky. The Flintstones?
The Flintstones.
What?
This new revised reboot of the Flintstones, of Fred, of Wilma, of Barney, and of Betty, because it is social satire writ large. We have Fred and Wilma living down the street from Adam and Steve. We have Bedrock trying to figure out what god they're going to worship, and they ultimately decide to worship the god Gerald. And we have Barney and Fred recovering as veterans from the war that they went through together.
Right on the cover, it says, the best thing on the stands, you're not reading, Wired. Okay. A. David Lewis, here now, is expert on religion and comic books. He also has a new book coming out that he co-edits called Muslim Superheroes, Comics, Islam, and Representation. A. Dave, always a pleasure. Thank you.
So nice to be here. Thank you, Robin.
Well, a Navajo heavy metal band has just released its first album. They call themselves I Don't Conform. That's don't without an apostrophe and conform with a K. And unless you live on the Navajo Reservation in northeastern Arizona, you've probably not heard of them. But recently, the band got the attention of one of the most sought-after producers in the world, the guy behind Metallica. Laurel Morales from the Fronteras Desk at Here Now contributor KJZZ has this profile of I Don't Conform.
The band practices in what appears to be a traditional Navajo dwelling called a hogan in Window Rock, the capital of the Navajo Nation. But once inside, it's a typical man cave, complete with pinups and a velvet painting of an eagle. The amps are cranked, but lead singer Kyle Felter says there are no neighbors to complain here.
I love the anger of it, I guess. And it gives me a, you know, adrenaline rush every time. After you're done, you know, screaming in the mic and playing, it's just like you're relaxed. You know, you feel cleansed, I guess. Playing metal guitar is the best therapy for me.
Felter isn't the only one who has to release some aggression. Heavy metal has risen in popularity among young Navajos over the last couple of decades.
What's happening here, you know, can't find jobs. You see everybody suffering from, you know, cancer. There's people drunk. It's hard to live here, but I want to live here.
Felter wrote the track EPA. It's actually a more colorful name for the federal agency, after it accidentally spilled 3 million gallons of mine waste into a Southwest river system 2 years ago. I Don't Conform's lyrics focus on the spill, but also on the tribe's deadly legacy of uranium mining contamination. The agency has been working with the tribe over the last several years to clean it up. Felter sings, to protect us, not infect us, is your responsibility. To nurture, not to murder, but now you turn your back for greed.
We've been through much worse. You poisoned Mother Earth. Nothing but a bunch of crooks. Darkness controls.
The suicide rate among young American Indians is twice the national average. Felter's cousin, who played drums for the band, committed suicide last year. Felter wrote Time to Go as a tribute to the 29-year-old.
This obsession with depression is choking me. I can't breathe, I can't eat, I can't sleep, I'm so weak. It's taking over my life, nothing I do is right. Tonight is the night, I end my life.
The band's story of oppression and depression is what appealed to Grammy Award-winning Metallica producer Fleming Rasmussen. Felter found him on the internet. He thought they never stood a chance of getting Rasmussen's attention, but he knew he had to try.
He's like one of the top five producers in the world, so he's used to getting the best stuff all the time, and we come in with this bombed out, you know, demos, and it was about a little less than a week later I got a response, and he was like, because I really like your... you guys' aggression and your music, you guys' story is interesting. And he was like, I really want to get this project going.
The only problem was the money. Rasmussen's studio is in Denmark, and he charged the band $1,000 a day for a 10-day recording session. So the band raised the money hosting shows, selling food at flea markets, and borrowing from their families. Last summer, they finally made the trip, which turned into an epic journey. They flew the cheapest way they possibly could on standby, crisscrossing the country a couple of times and sleeping in airports. It took them 4 days to get there. Bass player Brett Begay was nervous.
Well, to me, it was scary because I'd never been on a plane before.
Yeah.
I still can't believe it. We went over there. Standing there like, what is everybody staring at us for? Because maybe this is the first time these people seeing a Native American.
I Don't Conform has just released their album at the Rock the Capitol Music Festival in Window Rock. The band plans to use the proceeds to pay back everyone they owe. They hope there's enough left over to record a second album with Rasmussen next year. For Here and Now, I'm Laurel Morales.
Love this. Quick note, this afternoon on All Things Considered, research on the viruses that cause pandemics. That's ATC later today. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.